started. We're having a little bit of trouble in Madison with getting the audio, but we're working on it, so I want to get started. Thanks, of course, to Mark Metz and Olivier Ryer for doing our annual ethics credit presentation, and today it's about malpractice in considerations of bankruptcy. I'm sure it's going to be great. We have Poison in back, thanks to Paula, so please help yourself. If you're on the Atkins diet, I understand, take some back for your staff. They would appreciate that. January, our date is the 12th, and we don't have anything lined up yet, but we're hoping that Shay and Sean and maybe a practitioner will do a presentation on the new forms. So, can you mute in Madison, please? Thank you. Anyway, so January 12th, that'll be the next date. Stay tuned for the topic. I've really been enjoying all the biker chatter about lawyers that are novelists, so I was thinking we should start out with the classic, "It was a dark and stormy night." Thanks, Mark and Olivier.
You're welcome.
Just before we get going on the malpractice stuff, I have one sort of personal announcement. Most of you know Olivier in one way or another, and those who have ever dealt with him probably have been wondering how anybody, especially a lawyer, could be so nice, so invariably polite. And the short answer is, it's because he's Canadian. and they just even driving over here. He was so gentle on the roads. But at some point after it became apparent that a wall is going to be built along our northern border, Olivier started the process of becoming a U.S. citizen. And a couple of weeks ago, to the surprise of some of us, he passed the entrance exam. And next week, in this very building upstairs in the ceremonial courtroom, Olivier is going to be sworn in as a new citizen of the United States. Thank you.
You have to give up your allegiance to Canada, you know.
I do.
And it gets
for the U.S. and all hockey things.
That's going to be hard. It gets Lennon me off the hook for never having checked his green card. For the malpractice speech today, a general overview is Olivier is going to talk about what is malpractice, how has it been defined. It's a state court cause of action, obviously, so we're going to be talking about Wisconsin precedents, what it takes to prove a case, when expert witnesses are needed. Then he's going to give you some statistics about the frequency of bankruptcy / collection malpractice or malpractice occurring in those practice areas as opposed to other areas, and also statistics about how malpractice breaks down into, you know, missed deadlines or failing to communicate with the client and other types of errors. Then we're going to go through a bunch of things in bankruptcy, all the deadlines and different activities that take place in bankruptcy that can lead to malpractice, including some examples of where they have or allegedly have. After that, we're going to talk about whose asset is it anyway? Who, if there is a malpractice claim, does it belong to the debtor, to the estate? And how do you determine if it was pre-petition, post-petition? And then if there's time at the end, we're going to talk about the ongoing debate about where these claims should be heard. You'll find, or I'll mention at that point, that there's a strong trend for the defendant, the attorney who's being accused of malpractice, to get it out of state court and back before the bankruptcy judge, where theoretically he or she has screwed up. But that seems to be the traditional defense move. And at the end, we'll give some pointers. So go ahead.
I will apologize in advance for the coughing fits with two little Americans in daycare these days. The winter is not easy. So the standard for lawyer malpractice in Wisconsin, it's been defined as the use of a reasonable degree of care and skill, and the possession of a reasonable, to the reasonable extent of the knowledge requisite to a proper performance of the duties in the profession. Now, the duty of care is further explained as the exercise of the best judgment in light of the education experience of the lawyer, but not held to a standard of perfection or infallibility of judgment. The jury instructions are very helpful. Judges will lay them out for juries in state court, and they'll say that it is a lawyer's duty to use the degree of care, skill, and judgment which reasonably prudent lawyers practicing in this state would exercise under like or similar circumstances. So the failure to follow that is negligence, and they have to determine whether the lawyer was negligent in representing the plaintiff in light of the facts and circumstances which the lawyer was aware or should have discovered at the time that the services were provided. So there's four main elements that a plaintiff has to show in order to prevail, and that's the existence of the attorney-client relationship, the acts constituting the alleged negligence, the negligence was the proximate cause of the injury, which is very important as we'll see later on, and the damages, the extent of the injury alleged. The last two elements, and we'll get back to that, often cause a trial within a trial, and the client has the burden of showing that but for the lawyer's negligence, the client would have been successful either in completing the bankruptcy or they describe it generally as the prosecution or defense of an action, but in our case it's usually whether it pertains to the assets or they would have been able to get the discharge.
And that's a huge point. As a practical matter, it's a very high standard for the plaintiff. They didn't get their rights in court because the lawyer missed the deadline or blew the defense or whatever, whatever happened, they're complaining, you didn't give me a fair chance, something went wrong because you were negligent. So they have to go in front of another court and show how it would have all played out and what the result would have been if my lawyer had not been negligent. And so that's the trial within a trial. And on all the cases we discuss, we won't keep bringing that up, but keep in the back of your mind that when the plaintiff has won, it's because they've convinced a jury that had my lawyer not messed up, I would have won, and this is how much I would have won. So they have to try not the malpractice case. They have to try the case that was blown in front of usually a jury, or if the defendant has his chance, in front of the bankruptcy judge. Go ahead.
There's a higher standard that applies when somebody describes themselves as a specialist in a particular area of the law. There's an additional paragraph here that we included that you can read. When somebody is out as a specialist and is recognized as one. However, in Wisconsin, most practice areas don't have a state bar sanctioned certification. There is some for patents and admiralty, and so it won't come up very often.
Yes.
Even though it's not authorized by
the
Wisconsin
State Bar? Yeah. It's on whether you're holding it out, not whether it's even sanctioned. Even if you're sort of in violation of the ethical rules, if you are holding yourself out as specializing in bankruptcy, you're supposed to say practice limited to or only accepting cases in bankruptcy. You can't say you're a bankruptcy specialist. But whether it's board certified or state authorized or just your own idea of your own qualities. If you're holding yourself out as a specialist, you're going to be compared to other specialists rather than a generalist.
Contributory negligence by the client is a defense to liability, and it comes up often. So are unclean hands and the doctrine of in pari delicto, equal fault, which usually falls back to the defendant position being stronger, and so there's a bias for the defendant in those actions. The statute of limitations under 893.53 applies to 6-year statute of limitations, and it also points out in the rules that a lawyer can't negotiate away a malpractice claim without the client being represented by another lawyer and independently advised. So the Bar Association does this big research package that they do about every 4 years, I've noticed, and they look at not all malpractice claims, and I can't remember all of their sources, but they basically put out a pamphlet with all of their analysis of the malpractice claims. And if you take a look, you can see here the most recent one was issued in 2011. There's probably one coming soon. The claims, real estate jumped ahead of personal injury. Personal injury used to be the largest area. Real estate after 2007, probably rightfully so. And if you take a look, bankruptcy is right around 10% or 9%, a little bit under 10. If you take a look at the next page, we checked with Wilmick, which is a local insurance firm, a malpractice insurance firm, and they had some numbers as well, which reflected a little bit differently. So they have their personal injury still ahead. The interesting thing to look at is that although bankruptcy makes about 11% of all the claims, the payout is only 7%. Most of the other areas of the law, it's the inverse. So if you take a look at personal injury, it's about 20% of the claims, but 28% of the payout. And some of the only other one I saw was family law that was less. I was thinking the theory, my theory on why is probably because unlike big lawsuits, there isn't a pot of gold at the end to be attained. So if you're just trying to obtain your discharge, I assume that the fact that the payouts are smaller is that, you know, you're being denied your discharge or maybe you're losing some assets. But in a malpractice action, there isn't a large sum of money to be recovered at the end. And their data reflected the historical data that they had, which was that bankruptcy is around 11% of all of their yearly claims.
And that's over almost a 30-year period. Those in the middle of page four, those statistics, you know, we're number three, yay. Bankruptcy is around 11% over a long period of time, and last year was right there again. Where are we?
Where's class from?
Me?
Yep.
Yeah. In preparing for this, you know, you search for malpractice and bankruptcy in the same case, and you get all these cases, and then you got to figure out where the patterns are and try and find some way to structure it or organize all these cases. And there were a number of possible ways. One is, you know, the issues and the degree of risk are different depending on if you're representing debtors and debtors in possession, or if you only represent banks, or if you're representing unsecured creditors. Leaving aside the collection side of it, if you're representing unsecured creditors and it's not a committee, you know, what can you do wrong besides fail to file a proof of claim? Risks also differ a lot according to what kind of case it is. Sevens and 13s versus individuals in 11 versus companies in 11 versus farmers all have different issues that raise and different degrees of exposure for the lawyers. One thing that we had statistics about, again, and this is a combination of the ABA and Wilmick, are the types of errors. These are their categories. Sometimes they're not clear. Sometimes they overlap. But the ABA, on page 5, says that 45% of malpractice claims are based on substantive errors, not knowing the law or failing to apply the law. 30% are administrative, 15 roughly percent are client relations, and about 10% are intentional wrongs. The bracketed numbers on page 5 is where Wilmick told us that they would put their, how they would break down the bankruptcy claims that were filed. So 39% of bankruptcy claims in Wisconsin, covered by Wilmick, are based on failure to know the law. Half, if you add the next category, half of all bankruptcy claims covered by Wilmick in Wisconsin are either failure to know the law or not adequately doing discovery or investigating. You know, missed deadlines don't really appear on here other than in you fail down in the administrative errors, failure to calendar or procrastination in performance. It was surprising to me that those sorts of missed deadlines kinds of things are 11% of the bankruptcy claims. And it's partly surprising because bankruptcy has just so many deadlines. I'm trying to think of another practice area that could be comparable and couldn't really come up with any. You know, litigation, there's a deadline to answer and to file a motion to dismiss and for summary judgment motions and to take discovery, but it's usually laid out in a pretrial order. In bankruptcy, there's just tons of deadlines. Sometimes they're implicit, sometimes they're, you know, they're stated in the notice of commencement of case, which has recently changed but still would have all these deadlines, yeah, on the new form. They can be in the rules, and when they're in the rules, they can count, they can start counting from the commencement of the case, they can start counting from the order for relief. The difference is in an involuntary bankruptcy, there might be a gap between the filing of the petition and the order for relief. They can count from the first date scheduled for the 341 meeting. They can start counting from the conclusion of the 341 meeting, which is why trustees often, you know, continue the 341. So it's a very complicated set of rules. Maybe some people have it memorized. I don't. We don't. We, you know, look them up all the time and always thumbing through the rules looking for what the deadline is on something. And then, of course, like in ordinary litigation, they can be established by court order. So often an order approving a disclosure statement in a Chapter 11 case will say the disclosure statement is approved, and here's the deadline for people to vote on the plan. Here's the deadline for sending notice of the approval of the disclosure statement, deadline for filing a ballot report, the deadline for filing fee objections. It can have up to a dozen different deadlines in that one order.
I think substantively one of the biggies is filing the petition itself, filing it too soon after a previous bankruptcy discharge, filing it within a year of a case already being dismissed and not realizing that means the automatic stay is only going to continue for 30 days. So I think the biggest, one of the biggest areas of real concern is the filing of the actual petition itself, and are you overlooking something from a prior case or some other issue? I mean, if you file it and just a couple days, you know, too soon, and you could have discharged old income taxes, for example, that's got to be, you know, that's...
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Right in there.
There's a section, a little bit of a section on that later on in the substantive areas. We'll get to the timing of the filing. Another big one is which chapter. You'd be surprised how often clients that don't get the result they were hoping for suddenly remember that they wanted to file under a different chapter. And in fact, sometimes instructed their lawyer to file Chapter 11, and dang it, he check the Chapter 7 box, and here I am. But
there's a couple.
The first one that comes up, a real common one that people think of, sort of comparable to statute of limitations for out there in the non-bankruptcy world, is proofs of claim, filing
yep.
proofs of claim.
And we normally think of it as a creditor thing. That's fairly simple. Under 3002, that's 90 days after the first day set for the 341 meeting. Under Chapter 7, 12, and 13. In 9 or 11, it's the time fixed by the court. But there's also one that applies to the debtor, and this comes in often for tax purposes. If you've got a taxing authority that may not have filed a claim, because they probably receive thousands of these notices all the time. So under 3004, it's 30 days after the time for a creditor to file its own claim expires, and the debtor has the ability to file them for them. And it's reflected in a couple of the cases that we've included. There's also from Pioneer Investment Services case, an excusable neglect standard for late filed claims that was softened. They concluded in that case that excusable neglect could include inadvertence, mistake, or carelessness, but I would caution anyone to be careful with that case. There was a very long line of other cases distinguishing or declining to extend that case, so it's not something I would rely
That's
on.
That's a Chapter 11 case, so it doesn't apply in Chapter 13. I get creditors saying, I have excusable neglect. My secretary was supposed to file this, but she put it in the wrong drawer and it didn't get filed. That's excusable neglect under Pioneer. And I'm like, but we're in Chapter 13. It doesn't apply here.
On an area that's ripe for malpractice claims is discharge or dischargeability actions. There are deadlines, again, two different rules, and the deadlines depend on what chapter the case is filed under. Those deadlines must be met even if the creditor was omitted from the schedules and did not receive the notice of commencement of case with the other creditors. If that creditor has actual knowledge, or if that creditor's attorney has actual knowledge of the case in time to meet the deadline, there's the case law saying that that they have to meet the deadline. You can't say, well, I'll wait till they send me actual notice. And now there's it can actually the Contra case shows how all of these deadlines can be a two-sided sword. In Contrick, which went up to the Seventh Circuit and then went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, the creditor objecting to discharge had missed the deadline but filed the complaint anyway, and the debtor defended it. And I forget which court of appeal, whether it was finally the district court or the Seventh Circuit, at which the debtor raised, or late in the case in the bankruptcy court, but at some point the debtor's attorney finally said, hey, wait, your complaint was untimely. But by then they had gotten to the merits of the discharge action, and so that the, you know, there were two potential acts of malpractice there. There was, first of all, the plaintiff, the creditor, having missed the deadline, they dodged the bullet on that one because the debtor's counsel didn't notice it. And we don't know, but it's possible that the debtor's counsel had, or the debtor had a malpractice claim against its own counsel for failing to raise that. The debtor lost their discharge and could have nipped the whole thing in the bud by calling the plaintiff out for being late to begin with. So all of these deadlines, either missing them or failing to notice that the other side missed them, can be result in malpractice claims.
Then you have the objections to claimed exemptions. Normally it would come from a trustee, Rule 4003, it has to be filed within 30 days after the conclusion of the 341 meeting, which is what we were discussing before. Your 341s get extended oftentimes when you have to provide additional information so that the trustee can make his or her appropriate decision. That deadline is strict, and even if the debtor wasn't supposed to take an exemption, if the deadline passes, it's too late. There are other deadlines to keep in mind. The intention, the statement of intent, I think in emergency cases, maybe for car leases, for example, you have to file the statement of intent within 30 days of the petition date, or by the 341, whichever is earlier. So if for some reason you file a case in emergency and you don't have all of the pleadings, you have to remember that deadline. And there's also the assumption and rejection of executory contracts under 365D. And if it isn't done within 60 days after the order from relief, they may be rejected automatically if they're not assumed. Then we have reaffirmation agreements as
well. Yeah, I want to spend a little time about Klein, the Klein case at the bottom of page 8. Reaffirmation agreements are a standard part of a lot of consumer bankruptcy cases, Chapter 7 cases. Especially the what happened in the Klein case is that the debtors wanted to file bankruptcy, save their house, And the things that are in quotes in the outline are from the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision, that there's quotation marks around it. Some of the other information that I've given you, you have to piece together by like going to PACER and looking up their bankruptcy case and seeing what happened, or going to CCAP and looking at the mortgage foreclosure case, which preceded their malpractice case. But anything that's, any language that's quoted is from the actual malpractice decision. So they wanted to keep their house. Their attorney advised them to not only reaffirm the first mortgage, but no, they didn't reaffirm the first. They thought they were going to get a mortgage modification, but they reaffirmed a second mortgage on their house, a mortgage that was largely underwater, with Associated Bank. And it was a routine case. They filed in, I think, December of 09. By March 10, the case was closed, and they had their discharge. Nothing special about the case. Nothing special about this either. They didn't get their mortgage modification. So by September, what is that, 6 months, 5 months after their case was closed and they had their discharge, their lender was foreclosing on their home. In a separate action, Associated Bank sued them for the deficiency on the second mortgage, and the Kleins, the former debtors, they negotiated a settlement with Associated. And almost on the same day that the settlement agreement shows up on the docket on CCAP for the Associated Bank case, the malpractice case was filed against their lawyer, saying that talking them into entering into a reaffirmation agreement with Associated Bank was against their best interest. The bankruptcy lawyer defended on the grounds that the reaffirmation agreement wasn't enforceable anyway, because when you look through it, there's something called Part D. We don't do a lot of these, so, but there's Part D. The debtors had signed it, but there were some blanks that they had to fill in on for disclosures, and those were still blank on the version filed with the court. So the lawyer argued, you know, I may have messed up, but I messed up twice.
It cancels it out.
You know, my alleged malpractice in talking you into signing this and re-upping with Associated is negated by my failure to read the thing before I filed it and see that it was defective. And that worked. that was a good defense. And to its credit, the Court of Appeals, you know, plowed through some pretty arcane provisions of bankruptcy law, and the trial court did too. The trial court concluded that the reaffirmation agreement was indeed unenforceable because of these blanks on Part D, and the Court of Appeals affirmed that. And then I asked, kind of tongue in cheek, how many acts of malpractice can you count? We've named the two by the bankruptcy lawyer, but there was another lawyer, and this is a pretty tough one, but there's another lawyer who told them to settle with Associated Bank, who could have, in that case, defended the Associated Bank case by saying, this, you know, you don't have a reaffirmation thing, this isn't enforceable, and didn't. Settled with them, they paid some money to Associated Bank, turned around and sued their lawyer, only to find out that. So, I mean, it would be a hard call for somebody defending an action by a bank to pick out that the reaffirmation agreement was unenforceable. But there you go.
Yeah, I think you're between a rock and a hard place in this area of law. I get invited over to talk to the staff attorneys, the intake people at OLR, and explain some of the bankruptcy concepts to them. And they told me that the number one call they get at OLR, now that's not malpractice per se, but it's your ethics complaints getting filed. The number one complaint about bankruptcy is my lawyer didn't get me to sign a reaffirmation agreement, and now I'm trying to refinance or sell or do something, and I can't do it. And the lender is telling me it's because my lawyer screwed up and didn't get me to sign a reaffirmation agreement. When if you looked at the case as a bankruptcy lawyer, you would say this is no way in your best interest to sign this reaffirmation agreement. But So I don't know what the answer is, except to say, just be very careful. I mean, have the CYA letters in this area especially.
I was going to say the number one question I think I get as a trustee is, you know, I want to reaffirm my debt to Ford Motor Credit or on my mortgage or whatever, and then before I know they have a lawyer sometimes, you know, my lawyer didn't get a reaffirmation on this mortgage or that mortgage, because they want it. You know, lots of times when they want to keep the home, and I don't know what the lawyers do on the other side, because I don't see it with the pro se's, you know, I send them to the help desk.
Yeah, it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of thing, and I guess you can always have them sign a reaffirmation and leave some blanks in it and cover yourself.
Some other deadlines, a basic one, just answering a motion for relief. We have this case here, Nelson versus Taoka, and that was a Chapter 11 council that was sued by their debtors for failing to respond to a secured creditor's motion for relief. Relief was granted and the case was converted. Now, this goes to what we were discussing before, the trial within the trial. The court found that the breach of duty and the damages were very clear, but not the causation. They had to show that but for the lawyer's failure to respond to the motion for relief, they would have been able to confirm a plan, and the retired bankruptcy judge, who was the expert witness, couldn't say that they'd been able, that they would have been able to confirm a plan. So.
All right, on bottom page 9, a lot of page 10, the point here is that there's deadlines and deadlines and deadlines. Commencing preferences, objecting to disclosure statement, exclusive periods for filing the plan. We're not going to go through all those. Bottom of page 10 is the point that Judge Kelly was talking about, the timing of the bankruptcy itself. There's a couple of cases here, one on exactly what you said, on freezing, waiting long enough so that debts are old and cold, tax obligations are old and cold and can be discharged, and not filing prematurely and locking in a tax obligation is non-dischargeable. There's also the reference to prior cases and dismissal of prior cases. There's the Justice versus Carter case in which the farm debtor's attorney told them to wait until after the sheriff's sale to file Chapter 12, and their case didn't work out very well. One of the interesting things was the Ehlers case, which went up to the Supreme Court, but started in the Eighth Circuit where these debtors were. The Ehlers case had, I believe it held that sweat equity can be new value for purposes of the absolute priority rule, that you can keep your equity and reorganize if what the debtors, owners commit is to work really hard on the future business. And the Supreme Court later said, no, it's got to be something more concrete than that. It's got to be money or money equivalent. But their case occurred in the gap when the binding precedent in their jurisdiction was the Ehlers case, as the Eighth Circuit said it. And they said, you shouldn't have instructed the jury that the law is the way the Supreme Court later said it is. You should have instructed them that at the time when our case was filed, we could have confirmed a plan because the Eighth Circuit had it wrong, but it was binding. They also wanted to introduce evidence of the fact that the bankruptcy judge that they were before always confirmed every plan. I mean, there was a pro debtor judge, and especially for farm reorganizations, and the Eighth Circuit said, no, we're not going to. Part of the trial within the trial is not going to be how that particular judge would have decided the case. The trial within the trial is how a reasonable judge, and now it's going to be a reasonable jury, would come out on these issues. How would a reasonable jury have ruled on confirmation of your plan? Let's skip over to substantive errors, starting on page 12. Is that still me?
Yep. The Berlines.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, here's another Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision. This is going to fall under the category of sort of red flags that, and know your client and run from some of them. These people were being sued for fraud and misrepresentation, and a lawyer defended them, and they settled the case for $40,000. Several years later, they filed Chapter 7, and we believe that they must have listed the malpractice claim on their schedules. It's too old for the to pull up on PACER, but in the state court case, the trustee was included as a plaintiff in this malpractice case, saying you represented me badly in state court and I shouldn't have settled. And the trial court ruled, and the Court of Appeals affirmed, that bankruptcy is one of those specialized areas of law that you have to, the plaintiff who wants to prove their case within a case must produce expert testimony. We can't just leave it to a jury to decide how bankruptcy law works. And the plaintiff in that case did not have an expert witness. The defendant had did have one, Mark Bromley, in fact, when he was practicing. One of the things that doesn't come up anywhere is that these same plaintiffs, the debtors, had a 1993 bankruptcy where they got a discharge. And then three, 4 years later, they complained that their attorney didn't tell them that this debt that they were settling could have been discharged and they shouldn't have settled it. You know, there's a possibility that they were more familiar with discharge than their litigation attorney. And for what it's worth, they got their third one, their third discharge, just after the 8-year waiting period. So,
Mark, just a point of interest, if these are the same Bellars as I was involved in the 1993 case in which they failed to schedule an affidavit. They listed one claim they had, and then they listed, but they omitted another claim that they owned. And the issue came up several years later when they were suing on that omitted claim, whether they could actually sue it. Judge Eisenberg allowed the reopening of the case and the scheduling of the asset, but if it's the same Bellars as they were very familiar with.
Yeah, I couldn't go back to the 90s. Again, PACER, PACER at some point, you can't really see the documents that are filed.
Mm-hmm. In continuing on whether or not the advice to file is good, you have the Banks versus Hendershot case where the client was found liable for administrative costs of $29,000 that he incurred after filing and losing property through strict foreclosure. The key here was that the jury concluded that one alternative would have been to do nothing, and they wouldn't have incurred those costs, so in that case, it stuck. You also have Enriquez versus Smith. In that one, the lawyer, in completing the schedule, valued the debtor's home at $30,000, and this is in 1985. I don't know what the exemption amount was back then, but on his own experience, he put down a value of $30,000. At the $341,000, the debtor testified that the home was worth $40,000, so the trustee objected to the exemption and demanded that the debtor purchase the interest for $12,000, even though all the claims included were only for $6,000. The debtor ended up taking out an interest-only mortgage of $17,000 with a 2-year balloon, paid the trustee and received the rest in cash, but because the debtor was living on fixed income, was unable to come through with the money when the loan came due and was forced to sell the home, the jury awarded the debtor in that case $15,000 against the lawyer because obtaining an appraisal or seeking a dismissal were viable alternatives in that case, and that was never explained to the debtor.
Let's skip.
Sure.
So
which to use?
Yeah,
sure.
We're going to skip. Well, on page 13, we talked a little bit about which chapter to use. There's a couple of cases there where the debtors thought that their lawyer filed under the wrong chapters. On to the top of page 14, I'm not going to go through those two cases, but the overriding point is that exemption planning is another, like reaffirmation, another damned if you do, damned if you don't, you're walking the edge sort of practice area. It can be malpractice not to counsel your client to fully take advantage of the available exemptions. But you have to, you know, the courts, Judge Hutchick, others have talked about when a pig becomes a hog, it's slaughtered, and you got to find the pig hog line, and it's not always, it's never clear. So if you counsel them and they cross the line, you can be sued for, you know, they lose their exemption, they can lose their discharge too, if you push them too far. In the middle of page 14, you know, the Tenth Circuit has noted that lawyers face a dilemma, and then they quote from John Ayer, I think he used to be a bankruptcy judge, John Ayer's article in the American Bankruptcy Law Journal, where he said that the same conduct can be malpractice not to advise in one jurisdiction, but grounds for denial of discharge and possible disbarment in a different jurisdiction. Let's give, not knowing the law, perfection problems on top of page 14. Those generally apply, of course, to secured or would-be secured creditors. And a lot of them take place in the collection, you know, commercial law arena, not so much in bankruptcy. You want to do Evans?
Yeah, the Evans were about fraud. You have Evans versus Cameron. In that case, a debtor alleged in her complaint that she had $10,000 in cash to protect. She went to the lawyer, and she was told that you should just say that you gave it to your mother, and that would be okay. That's what she said at the 341. The trustee found out somehow. The bankruptcy was dismissed, and the court found that the debtor was at fault. And the language was that lying under oath is immoral and illegal. So that's the equally at fault in this case. There was no coercion or pressure or oppression or undue influence or great inequality in the two situations here. The debtor went to the lawyer, and there's got to be times when advice is so complex that relying on it could constitute malpractice, but lying under oath at your meeting of creditors is not one of those. So right. The debtor was equally at fault for lying.
Before before Christ, when I was a lawyer, I had a client come and a potential client come and say that he had filed bankruptcy. He had an inheritance that he had just received right before the bankruptcy in Iowa. And he said his lawyer told him, nobody will find out about that. Just don't put it down. Well, of course, everybody, you know, there's always an ex-wife or a neighbor or a old business. You know, there's some disgruntled person out there, right, Doug Mann? They are out there. They will find out about it. They did find out about it. And the guy lost his discharge for not disclosing this. Well, now he wants to sue the lawyer for telling him, you don't have to put that down. Nobody will find out. And because of this, Evans versus Cameron, of course, he has no case. You know, the debtor himself can't lie under oath and then blame the lawyer. So we see a lot of these cases where the debtors are coming and saying, the lawyer told me to do it. The lawyer told me to do it. And, you know, it's just something to bear in mind that the debtors are also responsible for not lying under oath. And now I think with the new schedule forms, it's even going to be harder for them to blame the lawyer because they're in more plain English, and, you know, so that should be hopefully a help to you. I know they're a pain in the butt, but maybe it's going to be helpful in that way so that we don't see these people on the discharge trial, the U.S. trustee trying to get their discharge denied saying, he told me to do it, or I told him all about that, and he told me not to worry about it, or whatever. So a good case to keep in mind if you run into that kind of person.
You know, I think all of the trustees ask at the 341 meeting, are there any, because last year we talked about this a little bit in terms of the attorney-client privilege, but trustees frequently ask the debtors, are there any assets that you told your attorney about that are not on your schedules? And they always say no, and so besides their signature and now the clearer forms, you can always pull up the 341 tape as well. And in fact, something similar happened in the bottom page 15. It wasn't a discharge case. It was a Chapter 13 was dismissed. Because of omissions in the schedules, the debtor blamed her law firm, sued them. And I misspoke before when I said that Bromley was the expert in that other case. It was in this case where he testified that the debtor could have never confirmed a Chapter 13 plan because she had 2 years of unfiled tax returns, and at the and the trustee had told her there's not going to be a plan unless you get these filed. Who do these things belong to? You got a is it a pre-petition or a post-petition asset? For Chapter 7, that matters. For Chapter 11, it doesn't, because a post-petition malpractice claim also belongs to the estate. You can the three circuit courts have considered the issue. You got to feel sorry for poor Annie O'Dowd on page 17. Who was the victim of at least two and maybe three negligent lawyers. If you read through it, it's just sad. You know, the first one commits malpractice, the second one looks into it and misses the deadline to sue the first one, and then has to pull out of the case because of ethical issues of his own, and the third one, I forgot what the third one did, but where the courts come out on trying to determine whether the cause of action is pre-petition or post-petition and therefore belongs to the estate or to the debtor is whether the act is sufficiently rooted in the debtor's pre-bankruptcy past. For a lot of malpractice, for medical malpractice and for a lot of other torts, you have an event and then there can be a delay and then you have damages, but usually not much of a delay between running the red light and hurting. In legal malpractice, there can be a long delay. The debtor can do something wrong, and until the discharge is denied, or until something else happens, there's no direct consequences to the client. And a couple of these cases talk about you filed under the wrong chapter, so the act of negligence was the petition. Did that, and the petition can't occur before the petition, but the petition can't occur after the petition. One judge compared it to heads or tails, pre or post, but the coin lands on its edge because it's the petition date. Is that, and courts have generally found that if the filing of the petition itself is the act of malpractice, that cause of action is sufficiently rooted in the debtor's pre-bankruptcy past that it belongs to the estate, that it's the equivalent of a pre-petition action. We got like 6 minutes. Yeah. Go to page 19, I guess.
Sorry. Yeah.
Well, Olivier mentioned already on page bottom of page 18, like other torts, it's getting pretty well established that for torts generally, if the debtor omits the cause of action from the schedules and gets a discharge or doesn't, and the bankruptcy case is closed, and then takes this pocketed tort action and goes off to state court somewhere and sues a defendant, that the debtor will be judicially estopped from bringing that action because they failed to list it as an asset, so they must not have really had it back when they filed their bankruptcy. Sometimes debtors will go back and try and reopen their bankruptcy to save the asset. Insurance companies who are on the defense end of, I mean, this is true for all torts, it's not unique to legal malpractice, are pretty savvy and will, when they have a claim made and are defending somebody, they'll search nationwide to see whether the plaintiff has ever filed bankruptcy, and if so, what was the timing compared to the date of the alleged tort. Where can cases be heard? Where should they be heard? It's a mess. It's a mess. The most courts say that malpractice that occurs in connection with a bankruptcy, whether it's the sufficiently rooted, you know, you filed the petition in the wrong chapter, or whether it occurs during the case, mostly those are considered related to or arising under jurisdiction. Generally non-core, but even if they're core, we now know that some things that are called core by Congress still are unconstitutional for a bankruptcy judge to enter a final order. Like I mentioned earlier on, the trend is that the defendants, the lawyer accused of malpractice, remove these things from state court back to the bankruptcy court. On page 21, I in the middle, we say, you know, why? Is it because the bankruptcy judge, who is then determining whether malpractice occurred, is also a witness in the case? Because if it occurred in front of them, and they're deciding, instead of a jury deciding in state court, what would have happened, the bankruptcy judge is saying, yeah, even if you hadn't messed up, I would have ruled the same way. Why are lawyers accused of malpractice so anxious to get back in front of the bankruptcy judge? One possibility is that at least in Chapter 11 and 13 cases, they have the argument that if their fees were approved by the bankruptcy judge, that that's issue preclusion, res judicata, whatever it is. It stops the debtor from raising malpractice because inherent or sometimes explicit in the fee award is a finding that the attorney's services were reasonable and professional. So right at the end, bottom of page 21. Best thing you can do in my mind is not take in clients who cause the hair on the back of your neck to go up. If you have suspicions about your clients, if their story doesn't hang together, of course, if they tell you about something that you, and they tell you you can't tell anybody else, and they don't want this disclosed, if, you know, none of us needs work so badly that we have to put our neck out there for, you know, a routine Chapter 7 or Chapter 13 case that just turns into not only a nightmare, a lot of investment of time in the case with the bad clients, but then defending yourself afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Calendars, so many days that we discussed, so developing some form of fail-safe or looking at the rules often. Keeping current with the law, the new forms just came out. 2005 was a big change. There are substantial changes in bankruptcy law, so it's important. And making sure that communication with the client remains open, whether it's CYA letters, but making sure that everything is in writing is important.
Yeah, keeping current with the law. Remember back to our earlier statistics where, 40% of malpractice isn't missing the deadline for filing a proof of claim. 40% of bankruptcy malpractices was not understanding the law. Not knowing what you're doing, telling the debtor they can use cash collateral when they can't, things like that. We can skip the last,
one minute.
If you're practicing in Chapter 11, and I can't remember, I pulled this up years ago when I did this speech, so I don't know which malpractice insurer it was, but I found a newsletter where a malpractice insurer was essentially saying, in Chapter 11, because the stakes are so high, you shouldn't try to settle things because if you don't and then have to litigate, your client is going to accuse you of malpractice for not having been enough of a bulldog. So their advice to their insureds in this newsletter, their insureds being a bunch of lawyers, is if you're in a Chapter 11 case, and I don't know.
Oh, my God, no.
If you see this, fight everything, bring every available motion, then you should never have been accused of not having been zealous enough for your client.
I think that advice is pretty bad, CPA, and no longer apply. Thank you so much. Improve Atkins' diet, have some cookies on the way out. That was very stressful. January 12th is our next meeting. forms, and we'll probably work something out for you. So stay tuned to the website and to Viper. Thanks again for coming, and thanks to Mark and Olivier for a great presentation.
You're welcome.
Okay.